Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September the 1st, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Ed Schrader, and he will be speaking on St. Luke's program in Luke 12, verses 32 to 48, how to stay blessed when the apocalypse is now. Let's listen in on Ed Schrader.
I'm Bible study leader this week at Holden. This is the fourth of our five sessions. We've been looking at Luke's Gospel, chapter 12. 12 was selected because that's the chapter from which the Gospel readings for the Sunday service have been coming in August, and today now is the first day of September. We've got one more Sunday coming up in 2 days, and that Sunday will be the last text from Luke in Luke chapter 12. We spent the first day looking at what I call sort of Luke's major wineskins for the good news about Jesus. And they have been put in these six little boxes, and he has three what I call wineskins, or three tags for diagnosis of our problem, of human beings' problem, then and now. First one being that folks live, even with wide open eyes and good ears and high IQ, still live in darkness. In one place Luke even says, or Jesus in Luke says, it's not just that they're in darkness, the darkness is in them. But even deeper than that, if you focus the x-ray to get a deeper picture, there's fear in human hearts. Initially, it's the wrong kind of fear. People fear the wrong things. That if you really want to be fearful of something that could really wipe you out, and usually all our fears are related to certain dangers that could take away or destroy something or some piece of us. And if it's cancer, then it destroys all of us. But the thing to really fear is to fear God, who is really the one who operates, who has in his hand a total wipeout clause for sinners. And underlying all of that, even at a deeper level, is this awareness that I am lost. Or maybe I'm not aware. The truth of the matter, that these folks are lost. And for Luke, that's a key term, because he's the only one who has a whole chapter on lostness. Chapter 15 of Luke is three big parables about lost. Lost sheep, lost coin, and the two lost boys. A younger brother and an older brother. We mistakenly usually call that the parable of the prodigal son, so it only focuses on the hell-raising sort of immoral brother. But the punch of that parable really is the moral brother, the good brother, the law-abiding one, the one who does what's right, and who, as the parable unfolds, is even loster than the hell-raiser one was, who ran to the far country and blew everything. Okay, lost is big for Luke, so it would be no surprise then if, this being the bad news side, that when Luke comes about the good news side, Jesus is going to be the one who rescues the lost, finds the lost, saves the lost. And for Luke, that's one of his major, if not the most fundamental word picture he has for Jesus. Luke is the only one of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who ever even uses the word Savior for Jesus. You and I think that's such a common word, you know, you'd say, well, it must be on every page. But no, Luke's the only one who uses it because he says, you know, the bad news is folks got lost, or they are losers, and they need a saver. They need someone to go out and save them, rescue, pull them back, find them wherever they are falling, you know, down the avalanche gulch or whatever. So Jesus, the finder, the savor. And from that then comes clear alternate option of what can be going on at this what we call deeper level, I'll just say the human heart, that joy replaces fear, and instead of darkness there is light, and Luke's word for light and for our action in the light is this word glorify. You know it from the first Lucan story you ever probably once heard, the Christmas story. And the shepherds returned after the big event glorifying and praising God. And they didn't just sing that up to the stars, you know. They said that to the folks. They spread the very light that they had now had from that mangered Messiah is the light that they promote it, that they expand it, that the chain reaction kept going for other folks. Okay, that's the basic paradigm. Let's now go and read today's text, first of all in Luke's own rendering, and then take a look at how that text puts additional stuff into these six blueprint boxes. Carl, you want to start? Instead of one person doing it all, let's just sort of do it paragraph by paragraph. We got a smallish bunch here.
Where are we starting now?
Luke chapter 12, 32 to 48. It's again a bit longish. It's 17 verses. It's three, maybe four paragraphs.
You don't mind the Gideon translation?
Oh, dear. No. But Gideon didn't translate for itself. It always glommed onto somebody else's. So which one is it?
Well,
it's hard to tell. That page has been torn off.
Okay. Yeah.
It's either RSV or King James.
Here, I'll give another one here.
No.
Oh, you want me to just read this?
Okay. If it's different, we should thank the Lord he gave us another option.
Oh, okay.
Okay. We'll go with it. Okay, 12:32. Fear not, little flock. For it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell that ye have and give alms.
That's already a hint as to which version that is.
King James.
It's Old English. It's King James Version.
Okay.
Keep on. We'll tough it out.
Provide yourselves bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens that faileth not, where no thief approacheth, neither moth corrupteth. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.
Well, that at least sounds like our language. Just for fun, since that's so okay. King James-ish, Flo, would you read your version of those?
I have NIV.
Okay, NIV is a New International Version. Ooh, that was a Freudian slip.
Do not be afraid.
Shh, strike that from the tape. NIV is a American English version with a kind of conservative evangelical support team that put it out, but it's not patently, you know, fundamentalist in any way, but what
okay.
Does it say?
Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will not be exhausted, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Okay, well, since we started here, would you then continue with the next paragraph in whatever you've got up, just plain old RSV?
Right. 35. Let your loins be girded and your lamps burning, and be like men who are waiting for their master to come home from the marriage feast.
Stop that very lingo. Loins girded and lamps burning is a clear reference to what? And don't let Buzz answer that. Can't waste time. Buzz, quick answer.
Loins girded?
That's a symbol of the priesthood and the altar and the temple.
Oh, well, that sure could be that, but I have a hunch that this goes way back to the first ever Pesach. When Israel is ready to come out of Egypt, the word from God was, celebrate this festival meal late at night, and don't get ready to go to bed, but have your belt on tight and your lamp lit, because you're marching out while it's still dark. Continue.
Okay, let's see, I'm not sure. Okay. And be like men who are waiting for their master to come from the marriage feast, so that they may open to him at once when he comes and knocks. Blessed are those servants whom the master finds awake when he comes. Truly, I say to you, he will gird himself and have them sit at the table, and he will come and serve them.
By the way, that's a very strange twist. This master's been out all night at a wedding feast, and at least he's going to come home tired, if not even a little tipsy, given the way Jewish weddings are. And yet this one says, and when he comes home and says, hey, you guys have been faithful, he says, sit down. I'm going to be the servant of you folks at the table. You're going to be the guest, and I'm going to be the worker. and serve you. Crazy Messiah who operates like that.
If he comes in the second watch, or in the third, and finds them so, blessed are those servants. But know this, that if the householder had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have left his house to be broken into. You also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour.
Okay, one more long paragraph. You got a Bible?
I can't. I haven't got my glasses.
Buzz, do you have a voice?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, Peter said, Lord, are you telling this parable for us and for all, or for all? And the Lord said, who then is the faithful and wise steward, whom his master will set over his household, to give them their portion of food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Truly I tell you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that servant says to himself, my master is delayed in coming, and begins to beat the menservants and maidservants, and to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and in an hour he does not know, and will punish him and put him with the unfaithful.
Stop. What do some other renderings have for the word punish?
Cut to pieces.
Cut him to pieces. That's the literal Greek. And some translations say that that's a little too gory, too bloody for Jesus. Would make it a little tamer. But the gutsy word is, chop him up. It was grisly as that sound. Okay.
And that servant who knew his master's will, but did not make ready or act according to his will, shall receive a severe beating. But he who did not know and did what deserved a beating shall receive a light beating. Everyone to whom much is given, of him will much be required, and of him to whom men commit much, they will demand the more.
Okay. And
who's on first?
Yeah. Some of you may recall in the older days when a gospel lesson was read in the Sunday liturgy, the old phrase was, here endeth the Holy Gospel. And when I listened to that last verse that Buzz just read, I said, boy, that is the end of the Holy Gospel. There ain't no gospel there at all. We now just say, the word of the Lord. And we say, thanks be to God. I have obviously thought about this text a little bit before, and I have the half sheet to hand out in a minute. And I have put this caption on it, which may not touch all the bases. Staying blessed when it's apocalypse now. The word blessed, I think, is fairly valid, since that's in there three or four times in the text. Now, that servant is blessed, and then the other one is not. The other one gets hacked to pieces. It doesn't say the opposite of the word blessed, cursed, but you could just as well say that. That's the antithesis, blessed and cursed. And that this phrase, apocalypse now, is my own addendum. And I stole that from a movie of about a decade ago by Francis, how does he pronounce his last
name? Coppola or Coppola.
Whatever, Coppola or Coppola, where he did a Vietnam film and gave it that title. I was surprised at that title, saying, who on earth in secular America even knows what the word apocalypse means? Well, maybe the educated would. But who even knows anything about its biblical, New Testament orientation? Because it's the title of the last book in the Bible, the Revelation of St. John. The word revelation in Greek is apokalypsis, which means take the veil off, show what's really there. And it fits in, of course, with the darkness night diagnosis, when things are kept in the dark and then suddenly, whoosh, sheet off, lights on. And you and I were talking just a smidgen last night that Coppola admits that he's glommed on to Joseph Conrad's book, Heart of Darkness, and done a sort of a modern reinterpretation, or at least an American war, Vietnam reinterpretation of that text. Where I think, Conrad is a complicated author, I think. I've read that book. But my daughter is the, and son-in-law both have PhDs in English, and so I have to check with them as to what it really means. But in Heart of Darkness, as well as in the movie, there's this one man who's making a journey up a river. And up a river, where the river itself flows through all sorts of evil and death and destruction. And you see that in Coppola's movie, machine gunning the so-called gooks and burning their villages, and this one drunken colonel just doing it for the hell of it, etc. You know, you see evil all over the place. Then he gets way up to the center to his destination, where he's supposed to get a hold of some evil man who may himself have sort of just been demonized and become sort of the devil incarnate. And then I'm not sure exactly what happens at the level of sort of Conrad or Coppola's point. I think at least what he wants to say is, to be sure, there is incredible evil in Kurtz, I guess that was the guy in Heart of Darkness, and in this crazy former CIA agent who's up there at the end of the Mekong River, or wherever it is, but that the Heart of Darkness is never other people, as obvious as that is. But the Heart of Darkness is also my own heart, or there is darkness in my own heart. And I think Coppola was trying to tell us Americans, you know, an almost biblical message, although it may well be that his movie so overwhelmed us that we didn't get that message to say, these are all Americans, folks. What's happening here is America. To be sure, it's in Southeast Asia, but all of these are Americans doing all these damnable things. And for allegedly good reasons, or at least pretend, or, you know, ostensibly. So, the darkness is in people. Well, that's at least Lucan, very deeply Lucan theology. And apocalypse then means, taken from the last book of the Bible, apocalypse is when everything's falling apart, when everything's going to hell in a handbasket. And in the last book of the Bible, the whole cosmos is going to hell in a hand, or at least it's being destroyed. The sun's falling, the stars are falling, the moon gets turned to blood, and there's fire and brimstone, and people are killing each other. It's a hellish situation. But we've seen some of that, you know, on our own TV sets now. You know, we've seen Rwanda, and we've seen Bosnia. And a couple of you may have been in Los Angeles a few years ago when that recent riot was. You know, that looked like Coppola's movie. And that's us, in our country, our world. Okay, these texts don't quite sound that grim, although the last two sound like they're sort of, when you're being pushed right up against the wall. In this case, it's Jesus, the Master, coming back and pushing us up against the wall, or at least pushing the unfaithful servants up against the wall, the ones who said, hey, Jesus, we're doing your shtick. Now, to be sure, we've had our fun, we've had our party, and we sure didn't think you were going to come home so quick. We thought we had more time. And those are, of course, an unfaithful servants, folks in whose heart there was not faith, you know, but its antithesis. And at least for these people, these unfaithful servants, I think they could easily grab Coppola's title and say, that's what it is for me, it's apocalypse now. Everything's being torn, all the covers are torn off, and the boss is putting a spotlight right on me, and he says, what are you going to say for yourself? And I'm done. Okay, did any of you in the other translations have alternate phrases or renderings that might show another angle on the text itself before we push on to the conversation? Does anyone have a Good News Bible?
I switched.
Huh? You switched.
I couldn't handle it.
Okay. Come on, you're a cultured man. You're interested in history, like the history of the planet and the cosmos and the ecosystems. Whatever. Did you check, Carl, to see what word good news uses in place of the word blessed at every place? Quick, take a peek.
Can you give me a...
Oh, let's see. Where are the blessed words? Blessed is 37, 38, 43. Those are three places where it pops up.
Well, this uses how happy are those servants.
38, same thing.
How happy they are.
43.
How happy
okay.
That servant is.
I have, it will be good for those servants. I'm not sure what
Makarios, isn't it?
It's Makarios, and it's, you know, Barucha in Hebrew. well, I might as well do that now. Right here. While I'm talking, listen, but take one of these. Here's my reading of that text and putting it into the six boxes we've got up there for Luke's blueprint. word happy as a English rendering for the Greek word makarios, the Hebrew word barucha, which literally translated should be blessed. I'm sure that the New English Version folks said, you know, people don't know what the word blessed means, and so we'll try to give them an American English word that does have meaning. But I think they missed the boat on that one. And not only I, but a Jewish rabbi friend of mine, his name is not Buzz, I know you're not, well, you are a rabbi, you're a teacher, said that you Christians have a real tough time with that word blessed. And the signal for that was, he said this just shortly after that translation came out, then the signal for that, he said, is the way Good News Bible translates the word blessed. It says happy. The Beatitudes, Beatus is the Latin word for blessed. The Beatitudes in Matthew 5 are blessed are you in this, blessed are you in that, blessed, 11, 10 or 11 of them. And he said, New English Version puts happy, 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 happy. And he said, it couldn't be farther from the mark. Because happy is a personal emotion of, you know, sort of good vibes, tingly stuff inside. And he said the word blessed's got nothing to do with that. He said in Hebrew, the word blessed is a relational word. Now that shouldn't surprise you if you're a Bible student. All the big words in the Bible are relational. The word justice and mercy and righteousness, all the relational stuff. And bucha, blessed, is a word like that too. So he said, you might be helped, Ed, if you would think of it not only as relational, but almost locational. You know, you are in the right place. Like, you are in the right place with God. You are in the right place with yourself. You are in the right place with other people. When? I'm just going to the Beatitudes. You are in the right place when you are merciful, for then you are on the receiving end of mercy as well. You are in the right place when you are persecuted. Because that, persecuted for my sake, because that means you must be connected to me in order to get persecuted. Sometimes just for fun, maybe after the end of this hour, but we'll never get done before the bell rings. Just read once the, let's do it, who cares? Go to the Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 5, and let's just read out loud those, substituting instead of the word blessed, and say you are in the right place.
What was this? What? I'm having a little trouble with that. In his interpretation, in the being in the right place.
Well,
it literally comes from the root to bend the knee, to bow down in adoration. How does he move from that to being in the right place? I suppose being in the right place is being in the right position.
It's almost like what you preached to us last night. You know, when you've had death in the family, what's the right behavior?
Praise God. It's not
to bemoan what happened, but it's to be in the right place with God and then articulate. I'm not sure about, you know, if you go to the root word of barak. But Carl, you with the game foot, the gimpy foot, would you just read those Beatitudes and transpose Matthew chapter 5, opening verse? And instead of blessed, just say, you were in the right place, or you were in the right place when? And just hear how it sounds.
Okay. You are in the right place who know they are spiritually poor. The kingdom of heaven belongs to them.
But you got to do a little more circumlocution. Let's say you are in the right place when you know that you are spiritually poor.
Okay.
Because then yours is the kingdom of heaven, etc. You know, I mean, you play fast and loose with the text, at least to make it grammatically comprehensible.
Okay. You are in the right place when you mourn. God will comfort them.
And also, make them all second person plural. Make them you stuff.
Okay. What was it? What was that?
You are in the right place.
You are in the right place when you are humble. You are in the right place when you receive what God has promised. You are in the right place. You, whose greatest desire is to do what God requires, God will satisfy you fully. You are in the right place when you are merciful to others. God will be merciful to you. You are in the right place when you are pure in heart. You will see God. You are in the right place when you work for peace. God will call you his children. You are in the right place, you who are persecuted, because you do what God requires. The kingdom of heaven belongs to you.
Okay. It takes a little playing around, but the idea is more, get the image in your head as reading that this is placement, location, and when I am in those location placements, and that's the same as, relationships, vis-a-vis somebody or something, in this case always vis-a-vis God, then this and this and this and this is part of the package. The second part of each one of those Beatitudes. Well, let's try that once as we look at this text, because three times Jesus said, blessed are you when this, blessed is the servant when he's doing this, blessed is the servant when he's doing that. Yeah?
Well, one of the things I've always learned about this passage, you hear a lot, is who puts a person in that place?
Thought you'd never ask. If it's in the right place, according to Luke's gospel or according to all the gospels, who puts folks like us in those, in that right place?
In the meek place, in the merciful place, etc. Hungry place.
Well, what's your hunch? At least, according to the Christian faith or the Christian gospel, who puts...
Well, if you're following God's will, you probably end up there.
God puts you in that place. God's Christ puts you. Or at least if you're a Jesus disciple. Disciple means one who followed. And if you wind up, in persecution, it must be that you were following the Master. And he said, hey, buddy, today for you it's persecution. That's the path. And then I think it's important. He doesn't say you are in the right place when you get persecuted. As though, masochism were the name of the game. Hit me again. It hurts so good.
Or let's make you give all my food away so I get hungry. And this kind of ties into the stuff we're talking about the other day. Is this an active?
Well, it's not only tied into what I did the other day. What's the first verse of today's text? It's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Therefore, give it all away. Give everything. Give it away. Give away. I want to get to that, but in order to get to that, let's go around the horn. Maybe the U of this horseshoe. Carl just read last, so Flo, would you pick it up? Let's just do the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pieces. Three diagnoses down, and then three good news up. What's in these boxes is just verses and expressions, from Luke, from this section, from these 17 verses, with a little bit of Schrader interpretation. But I try just sort of to harvest it and put them in the bins and say, now let's, after we look at them, let's talk about them.
Okay, first one is darkness, night. Ignoring Christ as master, making purses that wear out for treasures that thief and moth destroy.
Now, in that case, I'm inverting what Jesus said. Mm-hmm. He says, don't make purses, bank accounts, safety deposit boxes. don't spend your life doing that to put in stuff which eventually a thief, a robber, a moth, and one of the places Jesus says rust, if it lasts long enough, just oxidization will kill it. Yeah, like your new car, at least when they used to make them out of steel. Yes?
Clinging to possessions, 33. Not risk for action, no lamps lit. Unprepared, not alert. Not waiting for the master's return, not ready. And then not doing the master's assigned work, but one thing.
Every one of those numbers, of course, are verse references. You see there's a whole raft of stuff there. Could you come up to kind of a summary word or phrase? You sort of caption this whole collection. What's the nature of the darkness of disciples who are in that kind of fix?
Sounds like fees, me.
Yeah. You jumped the gun. Susan, to the next passenger.
All right. I was going to get you to peg it up.
I used to be when I was a kid. 7 days is gone forever. Well, I think one aspect of it is just dumb. It's just stupid. If that's your master, and this is how he operates, for you then to say, well, he's gone out tonight, I think we'll live it up here in the house, and just hope we get done before he gets back, and he won't notice. Some of that is really stupid. And even that one about making a purse, making a safety deposit box for stuff that itself will deteriorate, even if it's inside the box. all do? Why do we do that when, you know, the 6, 8, or 10 of us in here, you know, we're eight intelligent people, and C, we're BC, whatever, but, and we're concerned to be intelligent, you know, not dumb about our faith, our commitments. Why do we do that? Well, Luke says, I got a hunch. Let me look at number two. In this text, Luke doesn't. Oh, he does use the word fear. In open text, fear not, little flock. So fear word is used, but there are other terms that are used, and would you read them, please?
Okay. Fear, misfocused fear. No fear at all of the master's return. No faith in the master. Faithless, imprudent manager. Heart not on the master, but set on other treasure.
Okay, Luke here actually, or Jesus actually uses the word heart. Where your heart is, there will your treasure be. And heart was our key, you know, our key concept for what's at this sort of second level of both the x-ray for the sickness, and then when you finally get to the good news, what's the new heart options over there? The only thing I found here was that they were not fearful of the master returning and catching them, you know, with their pants down and well, not just that, but just blowing their stewardship, you know, their manager job. And they're probably, you know, getting themselves fired, or in this case, hacked to bits. Is there an operational fear that you can see, we could see in here? No, they weren't afraid of the master's return, stupidly. They should have been, you know, if they wanted to be fearful of the right thing, they should fear that, hey, we're not going to get this party done before he comes home. Could you flip it over to say, what is it that they were fearful of? Or that you could see that they, or we are. And Susan, you tossed the word in before we even got there. How did you a moment ago see the fear connection?
It just concerns me that I thought God is love, and yet, you know, there's always, every time you open the flipping Bible, there's all this,
Really? Now she's using Aussie profanity, so just pretend like you didn't hear that.
Okay.
Well, that's a, what's the word? That's a euphemism for something else.
Oh, is that? Oh, well, I'll say the other thing then.
It's the other F
that's
word.
That's how I feel.
It's the other F word. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't understand. Why should one be afraid? Why should one fear the master's return? So who is this master that's set up as?
We're supposed to fear God, not the master.
Yeah, but I mean, why fear God?
She wants to know why fear at all.
I'm saying, I thought God was love. What is this? You know, you better fear me because I need to control you.
Okay.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Okay, Susan's asking the biggie, or at least one of the biggies, the toughies. Why fear at all in this text if it's supposed to be good news, you know? This flippin' fear.
Well, yeah, well, and he starts out, fear not, and then at the end of this, in the end of this passage, you're kind of shaking in your boots, you know? So it's kind of paradoxical.
Maybe it's to show how really important this is. I mean, he was turned like hack to bits. I mean, that's
pretty grisly.
This,
you know, if you do that, you get arrested.
It's, what I mean, it's kind of like, this is important.
Here's one observation I've got. At present in our diagnosis side yet, we're not looking at, you know, should you fear or shouldn't you? Luke's word fear, we put in the master paradigm back on Monday, is to say Luke says fear is operational in people without yet saying whether God wants it or doesn't want it. Those of you who were here on Monday, we looked at the very Christmas story in Luke, you know, shepherds, angels, Bethlehem, and when the angels appear, and that's sort of Luke's first story. I mean, there's a couple of preliminary ones, but the first Jesus story is Jesus getting born in Bethlehem. And Luke says, and there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch of the flock by night, and lo, the angel of the Lord came unto them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them. This is old King James. And they were how afraid? Anybody remember?
Sore.
Sore afraid, S-O-R-E. which must have been a 16th century English circumlocution for what the Greek says, they feared a mega fear. The word fear is in there twice as verb and noun, and the word mega is in between, Greek word mega, biggie. So the first place we run into fear in Luke's gospel about Jesus is fear was a fact, regardless of whether God said do it or don't do it. And I think that's Luke's first diagnostic proposal or suggestion. He's saying, let this text x-ray you too, and see if fear ever shows up on one of the plates, you know, one of the x-ray negatives, x-ray films. And that would be the question for us here. And that would be the question back to you, dear heart. Whether or not God wants you to fear, what fears are you carrying around within you? And I expect you got a couple. I know I got a couple. I expect everybody around here's got a couple. And a couple of them are probably mega. Big ones. And Luke says, in effect, the good news is we'd like to get you unhooked. For God wants you to get unhooked from those mega fears. Because the first word of the angel after they did a mega fear was, fear not. Says, there are no real grounds for fear, not just generically, but the angel continues, for, here's the reason why, fear is not necessary anymore. You really don't have to have fear. Because unto you is born this day in the city of David, a Savior who is Christ. Our Savior is that key word, you know, over there on that side of the Bible. Whatever else is in the mix, the claim, at least, of Luke's gospel is, whatever fear you got, mega or minna, this crazy Jesus has got something to save, to rescue from it, to get it off your back or get it out of your heart. And it ain't just by saying, you know, think about heaven or think about God or whatever. It's concrete and integrated down on the ground, somehow interacting with this character. At least that's what happened with many of the folks he bumped into. They got rid of their fears. There's something about that interaction that made them fear less. Susan?
Oh, I was just going to say, well, if you're supposed to get rid of your fear, why is there all this guilt thrown all over the place? And why is there even mention of being cut to pieces? Or maybe I'm very naive. I don't understand.
You're not naive, but I don't think you're playing fair. But I wouldn't. That doesn't surprise me. Right now, we're trying to track Luke's way of diagnosis. And he says, first of all, lots of folks are in the dark. And even worse than that, the darkness is inside lots of folks. That's at least Luke's diagnosis, level one. And then Luke says, the way at least I heard this Jesus story told and the way it worked on me, the diagnosis got pushed deeper. Shepherds at Bethlehem are first illustration of that. That fear is in people's hearts. And different occasions will let that show. It's not that the different occasion puts fear in their heart. Luke is saying the darkness of the fear is in us already, and this or that occasion lets it show. You know, x-ray. The cancer is already there operational, or it's that little lump in my breast. I couldn't even see it or feel it. And the first x-ray didn't even show until it got a little bigger, or I don't know how mammographies work. But it's there. Fear is there. And Luke says, and you know, the x-ray, if you set it a little deeper, says already now the situation is even worse than that for lots of folks, maybe for everybody, at least everybody initially. Not only in the dark, not only fear room roaming around in their heart, and some of them are mega, but folks are lost. And when you're lost, it's no wonder that you got fears. And if you got fears, it's no wonder that you don't see things clear and, you know, things are mucked up. You don't have a clear picture of what's going on. Everything looks like night, and maybe it is night. So Luke's got this, at least I propose it, this three sort of step deeper x-ray. And then, in effect, says, that's the bottom line. There is no deeper x-ray, but that is it. That's like saying in a cancer diagnosis, we've isolated the carcinoma. What are they? They're strange molecules, I guess. And here's how they're working, and they're gonna kill you if there's no intervention. Here's what the prognosis is on this side. Here's the way it'll keep on going, etc. To which then the whole good news is, don't fear, there's something else in the mix that can cope with that. And his name happened to be Jesus. At least that's the Christian proposal. If you're in most of East Asia, they'll say the Buddha is our proposal for how you can cope with what's killing people. If you're in the Middle East or in Nigeria, the biggest Muslim country in Africa, bigger, a lot more Muslims in Nigeria, almost 50 million, than there are in Egypt, Muhammad has an alternative proposal for how to cope, you know, with the death diagnosis. American secularism has an alternative proposal for how to cope with whatever the deep diagnosis is. And I don't think our secular culture diagnoses that deeply. Probably goes to number one and number two. And to say, you know, we gotta get at people's internal attitudes and anxieties and fears, cure them, and then we got whole people again. The scriptures, or at least the New Testament says, no, you gotta go one step deeper, because there's still an uncured root if you just help people get over their hang-ups. Carl, you've been trying to fly again while I've been babbling.
The passage leading into this is a commandment. And maybe it's an isolated passage not related to the servant parable, or maybe it is, but
a commandment,
if
namely,
you look at this as a whole, Buzz would urge us to do, Jesus says, sell all your belongings and give the money to the poor.
Stop. Before he says that, there's a prior imperative commandment. And the sequence is not unimportant.
Do not be afraid.
Okay. I've got this signal on the board. I was hoping this would come up. I was saying we need to, Luke here, what Luke does.
Yeah.
You and I, a couple of us at least, looked at this already yesterday, this or a couple days ago, that Luke regularly changes the subject. You know, here the diagnosis is me, or us, yeah, us, us, yeah, us. And then when you get over here, suddenly you talk about somebody else as the subject. Jesus goes into the wilderness and finds the lost. Jesus says, I have not come to, I have only come to seek and to save the lost. If you think you're found already, you know, I'll be irrelevant to you. Now, Jesus says, my hunch is you're not found, but if that's what you think, you know, you won't find me interesting at all. You might even find me offensive. So here the subject changes. Here over here the subject is I or we. Here the subject changes. And that's one of the radical things about the gospel. The other day we said that's what makes the gospel so offensive. Because normally we say, here's what the diagnosis is. And then the doctor says, well, okay, Ed, now here's what you've got to do. Even if it's cancer, he says, you've got to take this regimen of chemotherapy or hormonal therapy or radiation therapy. And then, in terms of past history, you know, the specs are, you know, 50-50. 50% make it, 50% don't. But this thing changes the subject right away. But then it says, it doesn't say, hey, you guys, move from here to here. Because that would still leave me the subject. But this crazy good news says, guess what? This guy came from there to here. That's why the cross is at the center of the Christian symbology. He got messed up with our lostness and got himself lost. When he used the grim light, he got himself hacked to pieces. I mean, not literally. He got himself done in. And he said, I did it for you. That's a swap option. It's a crazy proposal. But tell you what, I'll die and you can live. In fact, I'll die your death and you can have my life. You don't get deals like that normally in the world. But this then creates a new subject. You know, there's a new I. Or a new we, a new us. And then from then on, that's the subject of these things. So that I and we are the subject. So these imperatives, those two sets of imperatives, be not afraid, sounds like an imperative at which of these two levels, Carl?
I would guess at that level, the heart.
Sure, okay, if that's where being afraid was on the diagnostic side, then, you know, Nick's fear would be over here. So that's the first of the imperatives. And from that follows then a second imperative. And that's the one you raised, but read it again.
The sell all your belongings, give
right.
Money to the poor.
Jesus does not say, just forget about this, let's talk about action. Sell everything you got, give to the poor. Nonsense. Jesus says, that is nonsense. Jesus says, when you come all the way down and pick up the new life back here again, you know, when this has bumped into your life, or when you've heard about this and it somehow has grabbed you, then the first imperative is trust it and don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even of the mega fears you got. And then it says, and the spin-off of that new kind of heart that trusts this crazy gospel and says, hey, I really don't have any grounds for those mega fears. Even though they still may kill me. You know, it's not that the enemy goes away, but my reaction, response to the enemy is changed because I got another hookup. And when you hooked up here, here's then another possible hookup. You can say, possession, stuff, I don't have to hang on to them. They're not mine.
And he's sort of saying, if you aren't in the upper right-hand quadrant there, or sextant, you're going to get whipped.
No, he says, if you're not in that sextant, you're obviously in the other one. There's no third option.
Yeah. Well, there is.
And if you go down here, here's what's the root of this one. You're already in the lost turf. And it's already happening. It's not that wait till judgment day you get your ass whacked. It's you're already running around lost.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question, and that is, reading this literally.
It's the only way we can.
It says, sell all your belongings and give the money to the poor. Now, there is only one social system that I know of, and it's alluded to in subsequent. In Acts, and that is basically communism, where we don't have possessions and all of the stuff of making a living is held in common. That's the only social system I know of.
Okay.
Where
let's grant
sell
that.
All that you own has practical application and relevance in the real world. And the question I have is, how does a person who believes in the literal truth of the Bible read that and not, and yet, I don't know of any fundamentalist who reads this and lives it.
Okay, how could one do that? Luke's answer is, you got to start here. If you don't start here, you'll never get there. And I think the trouble with most fundamentalist preachers is, this is all the farther they go in the diagnosis. People are in darkness and greed and hanging on to possessions. Jesus says, sell all you have and give it away. And folks say, I can't do that. And Jesus was, of course you can't do that. You're rooted over here. You're rooted where possessions count for your life, where you interpret your life in terms of what you got, where you almost make an equation. How much I got is who I am. And as long as that's going on, for me to tell you to sell all you got and give it away, you say you're crazy. Or that's a good idea, Jesus, but it ain't for me. Or even I tried and I couldn't do it. And Jesus said, I could have told you that. As long as you're rooted in the notion that what I've got is who I am, and therefore, what I've got is what I got to keep. Otherwise, I lose me. And that, I think, is the biggest one. That's where the word fear would come back in here. All of us are fearful of losing stuff, losing my job, losing my spouse, losing my kids, losing my career, losing my future,
but
losing my sexuality. And because so much of that, I think that's who I am. All of those things are made clear, gone, there ain't no me left.
But Ed, it seems like, I don't want to get on a tangent here, but I want to understand.
You wouldn't be the first one in this room right now.
My sister is a hardcore fundamentalist, and yet when I visit her, she's got a big house, she's got a Corvette in the driveway. And the house and the whole.
She's living in contradiction of that, even though with her mouth she says she believes every word of it.
How?
But the question is not about your sis, Carl. She ain't here today. So if we talk about her, we're gossiping. Jesus says we shouldn't do that. How about Carl and Ed, you know, and Susan and Buzz and Flo, you know, us? Well,
okay.
Obviously I'm preaching because I'm shouting, which is not a good way to preach, but why don't we at least finish this? Here's how I think this Luke and passage, these verses of Luke, suggest one might get to that. But that's the end of the line. That's not the beginning of the line. That, give it all away. And in order to get to the end of the line, in order to have those kind of, here, think fruit, shoot, root. Botanical image.
isn't the commandment sort of a an unconditional, like whether you believe it or not, just do it? Isn't Christ saying, like Nike,
no,
just do
stop.
It?
No, the answer is no. what I'm trying to say, and maybe we'll get to that, is that this Carl, and this is not unimportant. In fact, this is fundamental. I'll put this up here. This is a gospel imperative. Law imperatives are like the Nike one you said. Just do it. I'm the boss. I said so. Do it.
So that's like love your neighbor. Is that a gospel? Wow.
Well, hang on. Sam, we didn't finish this. I stayed up till 11:30 last night. Well, did we read? Who read the first one? I don't even remember it.
I read the second.
I think we're down to buzz.
I think we're down to lost.
Okay, number three. And once more, this is not Ed Schrader saying, CCC. Admission, this is Ed Schrader saying, here's what I think Luke's saying. I'm just putting the words in the boxes to get the outline. Buzz?
I have a question before I read.
Okay,
I'll read.
You can ask the question after you read. You're the first stop after you read.
Lost. Not blessed, but cursed. Blessed being the right place, cursed the opposite. Cut to pieces, put with the unfaithful. Own house broken into. Robbed by thief and moth of all treasure, self included.
Because if my treasures are myself, and that's where my heart is, then once I lose them, I lost me. Okay, your intervention, Buzz? Question, comment?
Well, I guess Carl and I have talked about thinking Hebrew versus thinking Greek, and Carl is doing a beautiful job of thinking Greek as he looks at this. I realize it's on behalf of his sister.
Yeah. Carl's got no vested interest here. No, nothing for me. No.
I would suggest two things. One is that the Greek, I do not believe, says all. In sell all your possessions. My RSV says sell your possessions, and I'm almost certain that the Greek does not provide for all.
Huh. Yeah,
the other thing I would propose is that treasure is the Hebrew mamun, and that means value, what you value the most, truth. It's the same word as amen, it's truth, where your truth is. So it's speaking of a value, of all of your value, your truth, not just your money or your possessions. Mm-hmm. And to think holistically about that one portion of the text, about verse 33-34,
yeah,
you must think Hebraically, holistically.
Uh-huh.
Or you get tangled up in the analytical, logical, rational stuff that has nothing to do with what I think Jesus was talking about.
What does Hebrew mean then, instead of all?
In the Greek, I don't think you will find all there.
Now, I was reading the Good News Bible, which does have all in it, but it might quite well
not. So can I just say, I often thought that it's just a loving thing that Jesus is saying, give it away, sell it all. It's not a law, it's because it's a principle. I mean, it's a principle in just about every religion and everything, that what you give away, you get back tenfold. So that's how I see it.
But that last thing is not Jesus' point. That's they give it away and you get twice as much back.
That's an investment.
That's investment. That's not give away. Give
that's
away.
Well, if he knows that principle and he is loving to us, then he's going to teach that principle. I mean, you don't think that's what's behind it?
No, I think what you're describing is still what I take with what is a law imperative, a law ethic, a law moral. And if you read those last two boxes, children, I'll tell you what I mean by that. I finally got to make it, I got to deal with you in terms of law. You'll get your reward if you do what I tell you.
Carl,
would you do the new heart, what I call, the joy, fear, replacement?
found, finder, save, savior. Jesus, the finder, savior. His life and work equals the Father's good pleasure giving us the kingdom. His first coming as master to seek and to save the lost.
I'm referring to Luke talks about two comings of Jesus. His first coming, the one that's recorded in there, and then these parables about the second coming. Coming is the master coming back again at the end.
Master to seek and save the lost, which puts us in the right place with God, served by this master.
And the bracketed phrase that Carl skipped is the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 6 times the word save gets used at the crucifixion. The mockers, 3 sets of them, say he saved others and he can't even save himself. And then the people from the crowd say, well, if you are the Messiah, save yourself. The mob says that. And then the one of the thieves crucified with him says, come on, save yourself and save us too. And it can't be an accident that Luke piles all those save words up there, because he says that's the kicker. If Jesus had saved himself at that moment, what would have been the case? Nothing would have happened in this lower left-hand box. We'd all just be as lost as we were. We might be more, inspired or more educated. But if he had not come over to our lost turf and gotten himself lost, he wouldn't have saved anybody. So the cross is the key for how he saves the lost with his swap business, his exchange. And thereby, he, in effect, you might say, gets into our root of the deadly existence and gives us his, if you will, new root, alternate root of a very lively existence. Or as I tried to scribble up here while some of the conversation was going on, a new rootage for my life, this crazy, strange Jesus. And from that rootage can grow, think of it as a plant, can grow a new plant, and from that new plant can come new fruits. Now, to be sure, they are radically different, but if you try to somehow have them make sense in terms of this, maybe do that and then you get your reward, you're missing the point. You do that because that's what the new root is. That's the new juice flowing. This is God's giveaway program, and if you're a fruit of the giveaway program, you're one of those crazy giveawayers. Even giving away, is, if push comes to shove, to say, fine, even my own life is something I can give away. Not that I would devoutly pray for it every day, but even my life is not something I have to hang on to in order to survive. I don't have to hang on to me. Well, that's coming in the last one. Susan, can you read that? Is it too dark up there?
Oh, no. What do you want me to read?
The last box. No, I've got
a missing one.
Middle box up where it says joy, rejoice.
Joy, rejoice. Fear not, little flock. Faithful in this master. Heart hooked on this treasure. Heart in the right place. Trusting one's own blessedness. Knowing what the master wants and his non-specific timetable for return.
Yeah, so you say, well, I know what the master wants, and the operation is giveaway program. And so what's wrong about this one servant who says, hey, the boss is gone, let's have a party, and he even gets plastered, it says, is not that, boy, he was immoral, but that he used the stuff that was supposed to be for the giveaway program, and he said, tonight we're going to enjoy it for us. And it's not what he needs just for food and shelter for survival. It's binge. Binging on stuff that the master said, hey, this was supposed to be given away tomorrow to all these other folks. And that brings us then to this, how you could live or would live when you got the new rootage. Flo, we're back to you. Would you put the
really?
Box up there?
Okay.
It's a small group. You get around fast.
Glory, glorify. Administering God's giveaway kingdom. Living by investments, possessions, give stuff away. Make fail-safe purses for the blessed treasure.
If you're going to be busy making purses, safety deposit box, and IRAs, then see, it blows your mind. How could you make an IRA for this kind of treasure? Well, maybe you could. We have to work on it. We only think of IRAs and safety deposit box are for the other kind of valuable stuff.
Dress for action. Lamps lit. Ready and waiting for the master's coming, open to his unexpected coming, enjoying his service to us, daily work as a manager in God and Christ's program, giving others their food at the proper time.
That's real contrast to that servant who said, let's have a party and blow it all tonight, because then for tomorrow, when the proper time came to hand out the goodies to other folks, there was nothing left.
Oh.
Okay, the pattern is, as I sketch it, you can use the tree if you want. A new root, from which comes a new shoot, from which comes new fruit. That's a little hokey, but at least it rhymes. Root, shoot, fruit. And over here, he's got the same thing, If the root is in lostness, then from the shoot comes fear, distrust, and the fruits are You live in the darkness thing, I gotta grab and hang on to it.